Good morning, good afternoon, good evening again to all of you. Janice reminds me of a favorite quote by Rumi. Quote, dance when you're broken open. Dance if you've torn the bandage off. Dance in the middle of the fighting. Dance in your blood. Dance when you're perfectly free. Unquote. Janice has danced her way through many interesting experiences and journeys. I've known Janice as It's kind of odd calling her Jan, as we call her Jan. I've known Jan as a fellow service-based volunteer and an all-rounder on our Awaken calls, which you're listening to today. What struck me about Jan was the dedication, excellence, and joy she brings to any task she has taken on. What strikes me even more as I was reading her story and preparing for this call is the vast breadth of her experiences that were possible due to her tenacity and her agility that has enabled her to fly gracefully from one experience to another. To name a few of these experiences, Jan loved astronomy as a child, played guitar and wrote music for 20 years, worked in the library, film and media department, got trained to be a therapist and worked as a counselor for several years, has been a Reiki practitioner, been an academic advisor and director, has dabbled with a business startup, has worked for human resources, is an actor at a community theater, is a meditator, provides voiceover services for self-help books and several projects. The list goes on and on and on. Most of all, these labels aside, Jan is a wonderful human being who strives to fill our cup of life with acts of goodness, kindness, and service. Jan, it's so awesome to have you as our guest today. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Well, after that introduction, I hope I can get through without choking up.
And I just wanted to check if that was just about one person that you were reading.
It's so interesting when you actually know someone. I've known Jan for nearly a year now because we work on Awaken calls together, and it was so fascinating to actually read about her even more and find out. And that just tells me mostly when we meet people and know people, it's really the tip of the iceberg. And all of us are just barely scratching the surface. And everybody has such a beautiful story and journey. And it's awesome to have this opportunity to take the time to know that. So thank you, Jan, for giving us this chance.
Oh, well, it's my pleasure. Thank you. And you're absolutely right. We all have incredibly beautiful stories. So, let's all share today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I thought we'll start from your introduction. I wanted to hear about what guides you as you, it's your experiences and so many different experiences that you've had. What guided you as you took those decisions and as you moved through your journey? What were some things that comes to mind as you flew through these experiences?
Yeah, my parents would like to know the answer to that, too. but a lot of what happens with me, this is what my process seems to be.
Mm-hmm.
I am deeply, deeply intellectual. As I say, my mind is my playground. Ideas are my toys. And so for as long as I am fascinated by something, I will engage with it. But I am also deeply spiritual. And it's tricky to live in a state of being in which I can do both, because it frequently makes me crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But what will typically happen is that I reach a point in a certain position, be it a volunteer position or a job or whatever, and it no longer fits. You know, like how snakes have to shed their skin. And so it is with me. And, intellectually and spiritually, I think, okay, what more do I need to do to stay here? Am I somehow resisting something? Do I need to approach something differently? And I'll keep working it and working it and working it until finally I say, nope, I'm done. It's time to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I seem to recall two times in which I actually had another position to go to. But generally speaking, I just kind of take a long step out into space and trust. And so I hope that when I die, my tombstone reads something like, she had a propensity for jumping off of cliffs, and while she never quite learned to fly, she was really good at landing on her feet.
Wow.
So when, at what point do, you know, you said when you know you're done, that's when you move on. What are, it takes a certain level of being tuned into to be there, because some of us are mechanically doing the same thing over and over, mm-hmm. and we're not as tuned. So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
About what it feels like when I know?
Yeah, what it feels like when you know that, okay, this is, I'm done with this, and it's time for me to move on to something else.
Okay. Often it is where I start to butt heads with people. And, you know, that's not necessarily a good thing, and that's often the place where I go into how do I need to be different if I'm finding I'm at loggerheads with other people. But often, too, that disagreement comes over ethical issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got an ethical streak a mile wide across my back. And when I find that I can no longer nudge a process or a project or a policy in a direction that is more ethical or more compassionate, it's kind of like you get this feeling of being spent. And there is nothing more to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I got divorced, this goes back 15 years ago, it was a very difficult marriage, and I stayed in it longer than I needed to because I was afraid to leave. I didn't know how I would take care of myself. But when the decision finally came to leave, I said something to myself that has lived with me ever since, and that was never be in a position where you cannot walk away. For some people, that may sound like not trying hard enough, but I think I really do put a lot of effort into trying hard enough. So I kind of check my financial landscape, how long can I last doing this, and that's when I say, okay, it's time to jump off the cliff and see what happens.
Jump off the cliff. I like that.
Yeah, well, you do it, Vinya, so, you know, this is fast becoming a trend, I think.
Yeah, I do. I did want us to go and go to that part of your journey when you made the decision about ending a marriage, and I guess this is a good time to ask you that. So,
mm-hmm.
It takes a lot of courage because, you know, sometimes we don't even realize when something is not working for us, and
yeah.
we go on doing it because that's what we're used to, or that's what gives us the safety and the courage.
Yeah.
So when you made that decision,
mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about how it was after you made the decision of what your thinking was, and how, you know, sometimes it's hard to know what is right for you in the moment, right? It takes a while before you actually know. So did you go through that phase of doubt and just a little bit about how all that was for you?
Yeah, I went through that period of doubt for 15 years.
Wow.
So I know exactly what you're talking about. In the marriage, and I have to say that, you know, my husband he's still alive, is a good man. You know, this was not somebody who was, you know, in barroom brawls or things of that nature, but it was... I think he had some very deep wounds, and they surfaced within the marriage, and I was not in a position to heal them for him.
Mm-hmm.
But that was back in my 20s and 30s, and what I began to realize, and with the beginning of that realization came the notion that, yes, it's time to leave, is that I had control by virtue of being a victim. And I don't want to suggest that people who are physically abused are somehow the authors of their own misery, and it was not physical abuse that I experienced. But we can get very comfortable being in a role. And if I'm a victim, then my husband must be cast in the role of victimizer,
mm-hmm.
in which case he is always wrong and I'm always, you know, poor me.
Mm-hmm.
I could no longer grow as a human being in that role. And when I finally got to the point where I said, I don't want to be a victim anymore, I could look at him and say to myself, and he cannot be the bad guy anymore. With that realization, I said to myself, okay, how can I improve this marriage? How can I make it better? And just this absolute clarity came through that said, you can't make it better intrinsically. It just doesn't work. You know, there's an old song from the 70s that says, you know, there ain't no good guys, there ain't no bad guys, it's just you and me and we just disagree.
Mm.
And that's what it came down to. Mm. So as hard as it was to leave, my leaving, I think, affected him far more dramatically than it did me, because I've been wanting to leave for 15 years. But it really was a matter of prayer. And I sat down and I prayed and I said, God, it can't be that I have to get a divorce. It just can't be. But what is it I need to do?
Mm-hmm.
And again, it was this absolute peace that said divorce. And once I said, okay, the peace just enveloped me.
Mm-hmm.
It was the right decision. And then everything fell into place. I moved in with my parents for 9 months. I got a full-time job. Everything I needed to conduct my life
kind of fell
suddenly appeared.
Yeah, I think the most important lesson for me from that whole experience is, you know, how you went away from blame to acceptance of who you are, acceptance of who he is,
mm-hmm.
seeing the goodness in both of you and moving on. That's what's beautiful.
Yeah.
Just shifting gears a little bit and going to your childhood, it was nice to know that you learned Latin and also studied Shakespeare. We also had to do Shakespeare in school.
Mm-hmm.
So I know, and also knowing that you were really fond of history growing up, I had a fun question.
Sure.
Could you tell us about a particular event or a person from history that, you know, that really inspires you or strikes a chord with you?
Oh boy. There's a few. I was completely enamored of King Arthur, and I'm not quite sure why, but that, you know, King Arthur was actually, I think, more in the 300s, although, you know, as you look at children's books, you know, they place it more in something like the 1200s or whatever, and I'm not sure why, but I could not get my hands on enough of Arthurian legend. I also have this feeling, and I can't describe it as more than that, of a past life in which I was a nun in 13th century France, and that image just becomes more
mm-hmm.
vivid every time I smell the smell of burning wood. As I, you know, 'cause the thought occurs to me, yeah, it was always cold and it always smelled of smoke, but I loved that life. And I think it's, I don't know, something about, I don't know. It's a real good question, Vinya, and I can't give you a concrete answer, but you know,
okay.
Sometimes things aren't logical. There's just this
mm-hmm.
inclination, because it
mm-hmm.
feels like home.
And there's this big familiarity, right?
Yeah.
And I know in my meditation practice, the teacher had mentioned that, you know, he was actually training a group of folks, and he just felt like he had known these people from long ago. He just felt there was this connection. So there must be something to that.
Yeah, I think there may be. But I will tell you, you know, as you ask about my childhood, if I can just share this one story with you, because it is so funny for me.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you talk about control versus freedom. This was freedom, you know, in ACEs. I remember being in the third grade, and the rumor was spreading like wildfire that the Martians were going to come down and steal us away and take us to Mars. Mm-hmm. And the kids were panicked. Do you think my mommy and daddy can get them to stop? Do you think, you know, if I hide in the basement, we'll be safe? And what I did was to pack a suitcase and stand outside in my backyard and wait for them to come. Mm. And you can just imagine my crushing disappointment when they didn't. So even then, I was waiting to explore strange new worlds and seek out new life and new civilizations.
Wow, that's such a cute story. That leads me to my next question. Can you tell us, you know, about that similar experiences in childhood that inspired you towards your inner journey, particular events or people or anything at all?
I grew up in an idyllic childhood. I am so fortunate, where we lived with my dad's family, and they were Italian, and as I describe it, they were old, they spoke broken English, and they were crippled. But there was something about being a child among so many elders, and of course my aunts and uncles used to visit Grandma and Grandpa on Sundays, you know, for dinner and stuff. But there was something about it that was so safe on the one hand, but it was not American. And I lived in this very culturally rich environment. And I just loved listening to adult conversation. And
was
my
this here in the U.S.? Sorry.
It was here in the U.S., but it was okay. This little, we called it the Dodona compound. You know, my grandparents and we lived in one house and my great aunt and uncle in another.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was not exposed to children's conversations. It was always adults and the way they spoke and the stories they told. And when Grandma died, we had to move, and we moved into the typical American suburban neighborhood, and I was absolutely horrified to see that, you know, people live disconnected from a richer past and a richer family life, and it was all about swimming pools and plastic cups and, you know, whatever else have you. So that sort of caused me to go inward, feeling immediately like a misfit at the age of 9. That's when I really started to go inward and explore Shakespeare and astronomy and music, and because it was something I could do by myself. And I think that's informed how I choose to live ever since.
Mm-hmm. And is that what you think might have inspired your love for books?
I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah,
there's always something to learn from books.
There is.
And books, not Kindle, books.
Yeah. So being a guitarist and a music writer, music has played played a big part in your journey. What does music mean to you, and what part does music play in your journey?
I'll tell you, I no longer write music. I barely pick up my guitar anymore. But music is both very emotionally satisfying, but it is also intellectually satisfying. And for me, the best music goes in places I cannot predict. So I'm very fond of classical music, and not that I don't listen to popular music, and not that I don't listen to jazz, but classical is where I really love to be.
Mm-hmm.
And among my favorite composers is an American contemporary composer, John Adams. And I don't know what the man is channeling, but he will write pieces of music that have multiple tempos and I swear the musicians have to take out extra life insurance because it must be dangerous to play. And you cannot predict where the music is going, and it is often dissonant and often harsh. But my being is on the verge of explosion when I listen to music that complex, because it just takes me right out of any physical sensations I have, and I just transcend wherever it is I am. And it just expands me, and I love that feeling of expansion. It's so music is a powerful conductor for that experience for me.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about your experiences with writing music. Sounds so cool.
About writing music?
Uh-huh.
I used to write songs. You know, everybody writes songs. But I wanted or just felt the need to write music without lyrics. And what I would often do is listen to a piece of music that I really enjoyed. I remember in particular, I love Erik Satie. And so one of the ways I expand my capabilities is to write something that's too hard for me to play. And so I would say, okay, how would Erik Satie write a guitar piece? And so I would compose that and just play it and play it and play it until I can get my fingers to stretch and get the body memory of how I position the fingers, because I don't read the music when I write it.
Mm.
Or there would be a particularly fine jazz lick. And I thought, wow, if I could write a lick like that, how did they do this? It's all in the bass line. Can I write a bass line piece? So music, when I wrote it, was a way to explore. But also, every once in a while, I would just inexplicably be channeling. And I remember being at my in-laws' farm. They lived in a small town called Ashfield, Massachusetts. And I was sitting out in the middle of the field with my guitar, and I wrote a piece called Ashfield, and it's still my favorite piece. But to say I wrote it is actually an inaccuracy. It was I was channeling something, and in 20 minutes this piece came out whole cloth. And but it's just strictly instrumental, and it remains just absolutely beautiful when I can remember how to play it.
And I'm not to spring a surprise on you, but if it's possible at all for you to play a piece for us, and no pressure, we would love to hear it. I was kind of thinking, gosh, I should have asked her yesterday.
Oh, God. Thank you for asking, but I packed up the guitar, and it's now at Mom and Dad's house.
Okay, some other day.
Yeah, I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay. So I'm kind of just moving on from those days of, you know, from childhood, and then looks like one of your early careers was in the library film and media department. Was that
mm-hmm.
in the early days?
Mm-hmm.
Great. And you'd mentioned that you loved old and foreign films.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you if there are particular films or, you know, particular experiences from watching those films that come to mind that that kind of really struck a chord.
Well, I'll tell you, this will probably come in a couple of parts as I segment different kinds of films. I loved American films from the 1930s. They're invariably in black and white, and if you're lucky enough to see them before they're remastered, you get this lovely, hazy, crackly image, which is very evocative artistically. But I would remember watching these on television at my grandmother's house and saying, my God, that looks like grandma's house. So it was life imitating art. I'd be sitting around with the furniture that looked just like the furniture from the 1930s, and you know, my grandmother wearing, you know, the hair pomade that ladies in the movie were putting in their hair. And so it became very vivid for me to live in black and white. But we had to view the films before we showed them to the public, because if the distributor sent you the wrong reel, you had to know ahead of time and, you know, swap it out. But that's where I developed my love for foreign films. Never seen a foreign film. And how rich and different they were from Hollywood films. There was one in particular called Tree of the Wooden Clogs. Some people think the film is unbearably long. It's about 3 hours. And it's made without actors. It's just people, you know, from a village. And it's a story about 1910 and four Italian peasant families just trying to survive on the farm and their life stories. But I thought, oh, my God, that must have been what it was like for Grandma and Grandpa. So that was very powerful. And then there are just movies that are so brilliantly written that you memorize their lines. And so one of those for me is The Lion in Winter was a play, became a movie. And interestingly, about Eleanor of Aquitaine and Henry II, again, we go back to that period of history I love, but just dazzling, scathing dialogue. And then there were just comedies, French comedies, like Jacques Tati and Mr. Hulot's Holiday, which was an homage to the silent comedy eras. And I still can't look at that film. There is virtually no dialogue, and I just fall off the sofa every time. But they're just charming, and they're so different from American life. And it opens up a window into a different culture, and I can enjoy it from my living room sofa.
Yeah, for sure. Now comes the exciting part. I've been waiting to hear your experiences with your counseling, with your times with being a therapist. So the first thing I wanted to ask you was, what inspired you to get into counseling work?
Okay.
And then we'll take it from there.
Okay. Part of what inspired me was being laid off from a job. It was actually one of the few times I did not, of my own volition, leave. And it occurred to me that people kept asking me for advice, or even at the library, I'd just be sitting there and people would be telling me their life story. And so I thought, all right, there's got to be something to this. And I just happened to be laid off from a job. So I looked around for counseling programs and picked the one that did not require the GRE. Lucky me. And so began my studies. And I am so glad I took my master's in it while I'm not a practicing therapist anymore. It was just, on the one hand, very intense, but on the other hand, it just opened my eyes to how I am in the world and how all of us are there in the world and how we really do connect in ways we cannot even begin to imagine. When we can drop the sense of control, like I need to fix this person, and let me add, it was not always easy for me to do that, and sometimes I couldn't do it. The desire to fix their life could be that strong. But when I could simply sit there and bear witness to what another human being was sharing with me, and it was invariably a privilege to have someone trust you with their pain or their confusion or their fear, you connect in a way that almost defies imagining, although I suspect with many of us in service space, we do have that depth of empathy and compassion. But there were often times I would tell students, because I supervise students, it's even more important to understand what the client is not saying. So you begin to pay attention to silence. What is this person still keeping hidden because they're not ready to go there? What is this person's body language saying that their words are belying? I can remember a young woman I counseled. It was just heartbreaking. This almost angelic. She was exquisitely beautiful and fragile, and she was incested at an early age and was now working in a gentleman's club, but clearly, you know, had, you know, some hidden aspirations to do something, you know, far more worthy of her intelligence. And she would speak in the most controlled, elegant voice. And I remember she'd say to me, "But you know, it really is just a means to an end. That's all it is, and I can stand it. You know, it's, you know, they're very protective of us. The men never touch us, and it's really okay." And very gently, you know, I looked at her and I said, "Then why is your fist clenched?" And in utter surprise, she looked down. Her fist was clenched the entire time she was talking to me. She said, "Oh, I guess I didn't realize that." And that became the doorway by which we were able to talk about something else. It's only in either a really special friendship or in the therapeutic relationship that you dare to go certain places. And you've got to, as a therapist, keep your work as scrupulously clean as possible so that your issues don't interfere with the client's issue. It became a sacred trust to work with whoever it was that came through the door. It wasn't always easy. I wasn't always successful. I wasn't always the best counselor I could have been. But I was just graced with some moments of deep intimacy, and I just have to hope that somewhere along the line it helped people to move on to the next part of their lives.
So what inspired you to do counseling? Of course, you touched on it a little, that it was amazing to be able to, you know, to serve people in this way. But how did that help you in your own journey?
So for me, it compelled me to take a look at my own agenda, not just with clients, but with friends or family members, and indeed with myself. Is this the truth that I am telling myself? You know, if we go back to, you know, the story about my marriage, why do I need to take this point of view? What is the payback for adopting a victim perspective? What is the payback for being spiny? What am I getting out of it? Because invariably, when we engage in behaviors, there's usually something we're hoping to get out of it. So the question for me now becomes, is what I want to get out of it wholesome, or is it playing into some hidden agenda in my own life? So I take whatever it was that I learned in becoming a counselor, and I apply it to myself to see where am I BSing? Where am I not being truthful? What is there some depth further down I still need to plumb in order to get to a truer sense of who I am? And those tools that I've learned and those questions that I learned live with me as I continue to, you know, make myself as authentic as I can possibly be.
Right, and you know, especially with counseling, it's so important to have those, to be very careful with our lines of boundary, and also being able to be completely present. So on one side, you have to be completely present and engaged, and then on the other side, it comes with a level of detachment.
Yes.
So how did, I'm still, you know, I'm trying to see how, can you tell us some practical things or practical lessons you learned from that experience and how they informed you in whatever way they did in your life?
Well, as I said, you know, I go back to the divorce. I think if I had not gone through the counseling program, I probably would not have gone through the divorce as cleanly as I did. But in terms of other therapeutic issues, you know, there are certain phrases that we learn as students that stick with us. Sometimes I'm really good at overthinking. is this what she really meant, or was she talking about this? And could it, you know, so I can get twisted up in those things. And I pull out a phrase that one of our professors gave us, which was, you know, sometimes a cigar really is just a cigar. And you don't have to think it's symbolic of something else. And so it helps me to also realize that some things just have to be taken at face value. And you can't really spend too much time thinking about it, or you just, you know, end up down the rabbit hole.
Mm-hmm.
Other things that I recall is, you know, it doesn't matter what your particularly favorite psychotherapeutic practice is. What matters is your client's preferred psychotherapeutic practice. So that helps me in terms of, yeah, I may want to get to how somebody feels, but they don't care about how they feel. They're worried about how they're acting. So how can I meet that person where they are rather than where I wish they would be for my comfort? And so those little phrases, those actions.
That's a big one, what you just mentioned, Jan, about meeting somebody where they are rather than where, you know, where we wish them to be. That's huge. And it comes up, and I think about it as I teach too, because I'm teaching now. And, you know, it's so easy for me to think, this is where I want the kids to be, and this is how I want them to respond to my lesson. But, hey, it's not about you. It's about what they need.
Yeah. Oh, that's huge. And I'll tell you, I'm reading Parker Palmer's book, Hidden Wholeness, in which he talks about this very thing. And there's a certain Quaker practice that they use where you really have to be trained in witnessing when somebody needs help with a problem, and how it is so not about you, it is about the person who is seeking help, and how can you just hold that space for them to tap into their own inner wisdom. It's an amazing book, but yeah, it's so important for us to remember that when somebody's in pain, we can't be in too quick too desirous of a quick fix, because what we're really saying is, I can't bear the anxiety of your pain, so quick change so I don't have to feel anxious about you anymore. Sometimes we just have to be in there with the pain with that person and just hold the space so they can be as they need to be. Very hard to do. It's hard for me to do. Mm-hmm. But if it's in our consciousness, at least we know we can say, all right, let me try this and stop doing that.
Are there any particular stories, I know that you have confidentiality, but any experiences that kind of stand out for you, that where you had to, you know, where you had to exercise this level of empathy and be there?
And there's so many times I failed, Vinya. And I have dozens of those.
Failed wouldn't be the term. I'm sure it was just so many times the efforts yielded different results from what you wanted.
Yeah. I mean, I can remember one very, very powerful supervision session.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all the students, and I'm there supervising them. It's their internship, so they bring the stories of their work with their clients. And there was one young woman who was working in an inner city school system, and her student her brother was killed in a drive-by shooting. And so Mary, my student, is saying, so yeah, I know how to work with it. I'm dealing with it in, you know, this and this and this. But she's just so resistant, and I just don't know how to get through to her. And she's talking very quickly and very matter-of-factly. So I simply sat there and I said, and how does that make you feel? Well, I think da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And she wasn't ready to go into feeling. And I knew I couldn't push it. What I did instead was I started crying in front of all these students. I just started crying. And then she just stopped dead in her tracks. And then she started crying. And then we held that space for several minutes. And the first thing out of her mouth was, I'm scared to death. I am scared to death for my student. I don't know if she's going to seek revenge. I don't know if she's going to try to go out and kill somebody. I feel so helpless. And so we process that. It's something called parallel process in therapeutic terms, where what goes on between a client and the therapist is replicated between the therapist and the supervisor. And so we talked about what was going on in the room, you know, that I was crying before she even was crying. Mm-hmm. And she said to me, "You made it safe for me to feel." Mm-hmm. I said, "Okay, then what do you need to do for your student?" She said, "I need to make it safe for her to feel." And that was a very, very powerful evening that will live with me for the rest of my life.
Oh, my gosh, I can feel it. And what a beautiful way to take her there rather than talk about it. You were the change.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I kind of want to stay in the story mode because that is so powerful. Has anything else come to mind?
Well, I mean, I can add, not that it makes it any more beautiful, but just, you know, to bring it down to reality. Some students were very uncomfortable with what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because God knows, you know, we may be therapists, but we're all individuals with personalities and issues of our own. And I remember one woman saying, "How could you cry with a client? That's ridiculous. You've got to be strong for your clients." I said, "Do you laugh with your clients?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "Why would you not cry with your clients? Why would you not show them how it is to be vulnerable? It's not that you're crossing a boundary. Their boundaries are clearly in place, but you can still be fully human and maintain your boundaries." And so it was a lesson for a lot of people, I think, you know, many of whom still balked at the idea of being vulnerable with a client. And, you know, you do need to be careful when to be vulnerable because, you know, certain clients you may not want to. If you're dealing with a man who's abusive to women, you need to be careful, you know, how vulnerable you make yourself in an attempt to model something different. But, you know, you learn the ways to do that, and sometimes you do it in a group rather than individually. But when people are that in pain or that lost or that confused or just going down the wrong road, to whatever degree we can model for them, I think that's terrific.
Hi, this is wonderful, Jan, to hear your story.
Jan, the other thing I wanted to ask you, with the counseling, with your counseling experiences, many times the change, you know, that a person might be having, that they might be getting through counseling, maybe very, very subtle, and it may not be as obvious. And so I guess it might be hard to know if the counseling sessions are having you know, an impact. So that's one part of it. And the other part of it is, how are these experiences as a therapist, how are they kind of guiding you in your journey and helping you to, you know, make positive strides?
How I'm making positive strides in my own life or as a therapist?
Actually, as both. As, you know, I think you did touch upon how it helped you make positive strides in your own life as a therapist. And the other main part is with, you know, with clients you work with, who's, I don't know how you would measure the efficacy of your counseling sessions. If they're making change on a subtle level, how would you know about it?
Right. And that's a great question. And I can remember a new client calling me on the phone. And, you know, they are consumers of services they are paying for. I expect them to ask questions. And she did. And she said, what is your success rate, and how can you tell if, you know, a meeting is successful or not? And I said, very honestly, I can't. I can't really tell if it's successful. You know, you could come in here and do all the right things and say all the right things, and things seem very assured, and then, you know, 2 months from now you commit suicide, and would I even know it? I said, on the other hand, and I'll share this story with you, there was a man who was not my client, someone else's client, who was a raging alcoholic, and he called his counselor and said, I got to come back in. You got to help me. And the counselor refused to see him and said, you need to get into AA. There's nothing more I can do for you.
Mm.
10 years later, the man called the counselor back and thanked her for refusing to see him because he said, if you refuse to see me, that was the wake-up call that I was in worse shape than I realized. I did take myself to AA, and I have been sober ever since.
Mm.
We don't know when we are successful. And to be honest with you, Vinya, it's a lifelong process. The best I can hope for is that I move somebody a little bit off center and onto a different trajectory. And it's not about completely healing someone because there's always layers and there's always more buttons to be pushed. Have I given them any more resources? Have I given them any more insights? Have I given them a way to see themselves in a different way? And then, as one very wise supervisor said to me, once the ball starts rolling, your job as a counselor is to get the hell out of the way.
Mm. That is so beautiful. I mean, you've given so much insight into how counseling, you know, should work. And it's really about leadership in practice.
Yeah. Isn't it, though?
Yeah. You're enabling the other person to kind of sort through their own feelings, see through it, and make a plan of action, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
great. And I know that your time in counseling kind of led you into your work with Reiki, and mm-hmm. I'm so excited to hear about what led you there and your experiences with Reiki and how it informed your counseling.
Sure. It was interesting in working. I got into Reiki because I was working with a client I was having a very difficult time working with. And rather than use a label, I will simply describe what was going on. It was a client, and if I were to use words to say she did this or she said that, it wouldn't make an impact on you. But whenever she walked into the office, I would get icy cold. And there was one night when a colleague walked past my office after this client left. She said, my God, are you all right? I said, yeah, I'm fine. Why? She said, you're as white as a ghost.
I'm sorry, she said what?
She said, you are as white as a ghost.
Huh.
And every session I'd have to put my coat on and sit with this woman and, you know, listen to whatever she was going through. And I thought, something's going on here that they didn't teach me. So let me find out about it. Another counselor was a Reiki master, and I thought, what's this energy healing all about? So I took a Reiki training with her, and that was when, for me, the nickel dropped, that there is more going on, whether it's a therapeutic relationship or any kind of relationship. It's more than words. It's more than behavior. We are exchanging energy. We are moving into energy fields. And what I realized was that this woman was so compromised in her own being that she actually had to hook into my energy and drain it off in order to sustain herself, which is why I always became so cold and why I turned so pale every time she left. And it sounds fantastic, and it's believe me, this is not, you know, counseling training. This is Reiki training, but once I learned that, it's like everything made sense. And so I started to approach energy as I conceptualized what was going on in a therapeutic relationship. And that really took me into some interesting places, but it helped me to understand myself as well as clients better.
Jan, I agree with you about the energy thing. I can't believe that I've never actually met you face-to-face, but I can still feel your energy and warmth and everything, and I feel like I know you for a long time, so we've never actually met face-to-face.
Yeah, maybe we have been around the block before.
Maybe I was also in the same monastery like you when you were a nun.
Yes, maybe. That's got to be it. Did they have coffee there? I can't remember.
with content, assuming that you were a nun. I don't know that you had thoughts of having been a nun in the past.
Who, me?
Yeah, you.
There was a short period of time I was thinking about it.
Yeah. So talking about Reiki and energy levels, Jan, so you became a Reiki practitioner, and I don't know how Reiki works, but are there general principles about our energy and how we can give good energy to people and how we can kind of channel the negative energy, or so to speak, that comes from people? Can you share a little bit about that for our benefit?
Energetic healing has many traditions. Certainly the Christian tradition, the Christ taught healing. Reiki is the Japanese version of healing through the laying on of hands. And so with that, we are instructed that we are not the healers. We are the conduit for the healing. Whatever healing needs to take place is between the individual and God. And essentially, we just work here. You know, we provide the hands, but, you know, we are just the conduit. And so in terms of giving good energy and dealing with negative energy, I don't get into a lot of the accoutrements that some practitioners get into. I don't get into crystals. I don't get into, you know, envisioning colored lights or stuff like that. But I do find that grounding helps. It's not always possible in the moment, and sometimes we just carry around, you know, energetic doo-doo for several hours until we can dump it. But I find that literally, you know, being on the earth, you know, going out into your lawn or a patch of ground and just, putting your hands on the ground and just letting it sink in is one way to help. And drinking water is another way to sort of get out the negative energy. And breathing, but, you know, we always do that in meditation as well. You know, can you do deep breathing? It's not always possible to flip a switch and suddenly you feel fine, because our bodies, you know, are going to react physiologically as well as energetically. So if something happens that releases cortisol or, you know, some kind of hormone or, you know, adrenaline, that doesn't go away instantly. And, you know, some people's bodies are more sensitive to others. So I think, you know, as we talk about negative energy, we sort of talk about the lasting impact of that anxiety. And sometimes it does take a long time for the body just to clean it out of our systems. So let's not pretend that, you know, I touch somebody's forehead and suddenly it's blue skies. It remains yet another way to conceptualize our being, and how can we truly monitor our thoughts such that we can ask the question, is this thought trying to control, or is this thought giving me freedom? Do I need to protect, or do I just need to be right? And when we ask those questions, even thoughts are energy. So change the thoughts and the energy starts to change. You remember, I'm sure, when we had Raoul Brown on our program, and he was talking about that very abusive boss, and all he did was look at him and start thinking, I love you, I love you, I love you. And the outcome was he stopped yelling at him. thoughts are energy.
Mm-hmm.
So let's, you know, it's not always possible to catch the thoughts, but, you know, thank God you always get a second chance and a third chance and a fourth chance.
You
always have the opportunity to you know, go in one more time and try to do something different.
Mm-hmm. And giving away to Kanchan, I think she has some follow-up questions and some callers.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, Jan, this is really interesting to hear about all these different stories from your life. I do remember speaking with you, and you mentioned that you were working with nonprofits, and and I was curious to know what your experience there was and what you learned, and then also maybe touch upon how you found service space and
how that will be.
Okay. I've worked exclusively in nonprofits, and I remember going to a conference once where Kurt Welling was speaking. Now, Kurt Welling is the president of AmeriCares, used to be in the for-profit, I think the for-profit finance or banking sector. And he said people often say to him, what's really the difference between profit and nonprofit? And he said the only difference, because there's always politics and there's always the need for money and there's always personalities, he says the difference is that nonprofits have learned that their survival depends on collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one good thing, is that people are always looking at how can we band together to make something more useful. And that's always helpful. I've worked in a number of nonprofits of different kinds. Libraries are nonprofits. Universities are. I worked for a public foundation where we got to give money away. That was great because you got to hear about what the money was being used for. And I just love the concept of philanthropy. I just love it. And then I had the opportunity of working for a human services organization, which worked with first-time offenders, ex-offenders, getting kids off the streets so they wouldn't become offenders. And then you got to see something of, you know, the less attractive side of society. But in that experience, it allowed me to see, even with people who were that limited in their ability to see their own behavior and the impact of how their actions hurt others, or, you know, were simply compromised by life in general, I developed some very great affection for many of the people who not only worked there but who were our clients. And so there were always opportunities to learn something administratively, but also to learn things in the service area. And it's been very rich.
Mm. And how did you transition to service space from?
And so service space, it's just one of those serendipities. A friend of mine sent me an article from Daily Good. And I thought, wow, this is a cool thing. Good news. And I noticed in the corner there was this logo that says, you know, this is a program or something of service space. I thought, what service space? And I clicked on it. And a whole new world opened up before my eyes. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah. And we've been fortunate to have you and moderate so many calls, and you're a wonderful scribe, and you also do voice, and so it's wonderful. We do have a couple of callers, so I want to give them an opportunity.
Thank you so much for sharing your stories, and it's just, I feel I've known you a long time. Thank you for that really authentic conversation.
Thank you.
I have a question to ask, because I feel that you might have the answer to this. I consider myself a go-with-the-flow kind of person who has never really been much to control anything, mm-hmm. or even a desire to control anything. So freedom to just go with the situation and the circumstances. But now I'm 50 years old, and I've realized that in the past few years there's been a pattern where I know there are some things I should be doing, mm-hmm. and I end up doing some other things instead.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of these weird situations where there's clarity that this is the right thing to do, it's a good thing for me to do, and yet I'm doing some other stuff and going with the moment and with the flow, and I find it an unusual problem because it is sort of like wanting to learn skills to control some things, mm-hmm. but there is nobody talking about that. There's nobody saying that you need to be controlled. Everybody else is trying to get away from control and be more present.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like you to comment on that. And, the energy medicine thing has helped me in some ways because I started dancing. Mm. I've always enjoyed dancing, but now I dance regularly every Sunday morning, like religious practice almost. And it helps loosen up that, blockage, mm-hmm. if you like, the energy blockage that prevents me from doing the things that I know I should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Sure, and thank you. And your name is?
Jyoti.
Okay, thank you. Rather than give you an answer, let's just do a little exploration, because I'm very familiar with being of two minds. It's a most uncomfortable place to be in. But what I would simply suggest is, are you feeling any sort of urgency that something needs to change, or are you simply feeling pressure from outside yourself that something needs to change?
Oh, there's no pressure on me at all. I'm in a very comfortable place, and going with the flow is perfect. It's just so comfortable. The pressure is internal. The pressure is an internal sense of, let me give you a specific example. I've written a lot of articles that I've presented at many, many peer-reviewed conferences. I'd never send them to a journal to print them. I love to talk to people about it. I will do a workshop for 100 people to talk about those ideas. But somehow to get them into the journal and send it off, it just doesn't happen. And I don't know why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The question it's almost hourly. The question that I ask myself is there something I need to let go of? And as you look at I don't know if the word resistance is a word that you would use. It's simply what it sounds like to me, but I don't want to put words in your mouth. But if you're feeling some kind of resistance to moving into publishing, that's, you want to sit with that and say, what is this about? What is the payoff for not doing it? Does it provide you with a sense of self-assurance? Does it provide you with a sense of anonymity and privacy? Maybe you don't want your name out there in print where other people can access it, and maybe it's a privacy issue. What does not doing it give you? Because there's always a payoff for a behavior.
I
would invite you to sit with that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. That was Jan, the counselor.
Yeah, and believe me, I so prefer this to being than being Jan, the guitar player. So, thank you for not asking me to.
Jan, first I feel very thankful to you and Vinya for gifting us this beautiful dialogue. My question that I'm pondering is around energetics. From your experience, have you found a way to put words around how you really feel the energy? Is it a combination of an intellectual and emotional quotient, or and then is there a way to communicate that through words. And from your experience of the coaching, have you been able to verbalize an experience before and after the exercise?
I mean before or after a Reiki treatment?
Reiki or any around the energy modalities.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
right.
And before you go, I felt really, you know, you tickled not just our brain and the heart, also the tummy. So thank you. Any laughter.
Prakash, I hope there is some day that we can actually meet, because I frequently hear you on the calls and you always have the most wonderful things to say. So I'm glad we're actually having a voice-to-voice conversation.
Well, the feeling is definitely mutual. And
oh, great. Thank you. Okay. Now I've forgotten your question, because what I failed to tell Conscience is that I have the attention span of a flea. So the question you asked was, oh, can I describe the energetic experience with words? I think that was the first part of your question.
Yeah, that is a very succinct way, yeah, to put
okay.
it.
Ultimately, I have to, because I have to communicate it with my client. But in the moment when I experience it, Prakash, it is it's only when I do Reiki, I actually have extrasensory experiences.
Mm.
And so I will lay hands on someone and I will either experience clairvoyance, clairaudience, or clairsentience. And if our listeners have not heard that word before, clairvoyance is where you get very powerful visual images. Clairaudience is hearing. And clairsentience is where you're feeling.
Mm.
And so often the information is revealed to me symbolically. And often it is revealed to me in a sensate manner. So I remember there was one point working on a client, and I had my hand around her ear, and I got this very sharp stabbing pain. And I will frequently say to clients, this is what I experienced. Does it mean anything for you? And in this case, she said, no, it doesn't, until she called me up the next day and said, oh, my God, I got an ear infection on that side of my head.
Mm.
And so it was like presaging what was about to emerge. There was another incident I had with a woman who was just horribly, sexually abused, and I was working on her on her stomach, and suddenly I became extremely nauseous, and you know, I remove my hand and the nausea goes away, and I put my hand back on her stomach and the nausea comes back to me. So I can frequently experience what the person is experiencing, but again, it is imperative for me to understand, is this my stuff, is this the client's stuff? And then I trust that whatever God reveals to me is safe for me to communicate with the client, and what is not safe to discuss, God does not reveal. And so there's always that feeling of safety, because you really walk into the sacred when you do energy work, and you had better have your shoes off and you check your ego at the door. And you just make sure your work is as clean as possible, because that is sacred ground. And mm-hmm. So whatever I experience ultimately must be put into words, but it's usually words that describe images or words that are analogies. That's the only way I can do it.
Mm. Wow. That's powerful, Jen. Since I know you, and you yourself said that you're an intellectual, it's interesting to see this side of you too, where you're very, because you have to be very emotional to be in touch with energy, right? So.
I wouldn't necessarily say that, because I will tell you, I fought it for a while. You know, this can't be happening. You know, because you go into your intel, this can't be happening. But you can only say that so long before you have to say, you know, there is more than just the five physical senses. You've got to admit to it. But I think being skeptical is always healthy, because truly being skeptical means keeping an open mind. And what better place to be than open?
Mm. Well, thank you.
Does that answer Prakash's question? I think there were several parts and I may have missed some.
Sorry. Prakash, is that okay to move on?
Jen, I think the one key thing I think you mentioned was this idea of becoming clear about whether it's something that is a visioning about yourself or the client that you're working with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
At the core, there is this fundamental understanding that there is oneness and there mm-hmm. is continuum in the energy.
Yeah.
And but the reality is at the physical level, we are still distinct.
Mm-hmm.
And there is that realm that needs to be dealt with. So if it is, for example, a trauma or a physical mm-hmm. pain, and I think that was beautiful how you described. And the one final thought was this: you know, if there is anyone, any being in the world suffering, that is our own internal, our own suffering, because it is the collective. And so. How do you process that when it comes to becoming clear? Going as a next step to your what you described about whether it is your own internal thing or whether something that you're visioning about mm-hmm. The person that you're working with.
Yeah. This is going to be where it gets hard to put into words, so I'm going to use an analogy, and I hope
right,
you find
right.
this helpful. And please understand, all of this actually becomes easier with experience. You know,
right.
for the novice, it can be confusing, and you start to doubt and, you know, go a little wackadoo, to be honest. But you begin to trust because there is such consistency. But let me make this analogy. If we're watching a movie on TV, and you know, let's say it's the part of the movie where the mother dies, and we're sitting there and we're just sobbing our eyes out. We really thought she was going to make it, but she died, and we're crying. But even as we're connecting and crying, we realize I'm watching a TV set. I'm sitting in my living room,
mm-hmm.
and this is a story. It's not real, but it impacts us. And so I experience it much the same way, and this is not to negate what you're saying, Prakash, about we ultimately all are one, because we are, I believe, but rather it is that experience of I am experiencing this vicariously.
Mm-hmm.
I experience it, but I know it's not mine, and I test it, like taking my hand off and the nausea goes away. I will actually ask the client a question: is it just me, or are you feeling prickling in your knee? You know, so you can feel free to talk with your client just to get that gauge, and then determine, okay, yeah, it really is because I had, you know, the chili for lunch today that I'm feeling like this. So you can dismiss the stuff that really is yours, but you do want to check it out because those are the keys to what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you, Jen. Thank you.
Thank you, Prakash.
Looking forward, yes.
Hi, Jen. This is Pallavi from San Jose. I had a question, and then your last response about your energy work has just blown my question out of my head in a way, you know. Amazing what you just shared. And, you know, I was just wanting to ask you about trust. You know, in the beginning of the call, you talked about jumping off the cliff so many times and you learned to trust. And now with what you're talking about energy, I can kind of sense that you're in a place where you now trust. But I was curious about your journey of trust. Can you share anything about that?
How much time do you have?
I have all day if you don't want to be packing.
Okay. So I'll tell you what, we'll finish the call, then you and I can talk.
That's a good idea.
I'll try to make it brief, but, you know, if you do have a longer time, you know, email me and I'll be happy to do it by email. Let me not leave anyone with the assumption that this is easy, because terror is my constant companion. And what I do is based on trust, but, you know, let's face it, nobody ever heard the story that Sir Galahad, in search of the Holy Grail, you know, rode through the woods for 3 days and found it. Invariably, he's got to fight the dragon, he's got to fight the Black Knight, he's got to be locked in prison. And so it is with our own stories. You're trusting, you are led by some internal guidance or, you know, divine guidance to do something. That doesn't necessarily guarantee that it's going to be a bed of roses. And there have been times where I have spent the darkest, darkest nights, you know, just railing against God. You've led me on a fool's errand, and just doubting my own sanity. But even when those moments happen, you know, it's when you realize that you're called to walk a different path. Now, I can pass for normal. Right now, I've got a 15-hour-a-week job working in a development office and writing grants. You can't get much more normal than that. But that's what I do to keep my life together. But, you know, I walk some scary landscapes within myself, but I have to, because I can't get where I need to go by walking the conventional life. So I learned to trust, not because I think everything's is always fine. I trust because I know eventually it will be fine. And that is a very important distinction to understand.
It's a journey, and and I have to process what you're saying, and I'll probably get in touch with you offline.
Sure.
Yeah. I'll send out her email to everyone. Jan, you're going to get a lot of emails.
That's good. It keeps me from packing, so, you know. Thank you.
Hi, Jan.
Yes.
This is Lavanya from Champaign, Illinois.
Oh, hi. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. I'm glad to hear you.
Yes. It's a pleasure. I actually haven't logged on to Forest Calls for a while because of some problems. But it's so nice to be on this one, and I'm really happy to be sort of back in the swing of things.
Well, we're all pleased to have you back.
Thank you. So I think my question is probably related to what I've been sort of searching for over the past few months, and that's been a lot of internal questions which haven't gone away. In fact, I think they're just increasing. And that has sort of something to do with what you said about the trust and doubting your own sanity. So kind of really struck a chord there that whatever I am doing, is it sane? Is it reasonable? Am I stupid? I don't know, many different things. So I really wanted to ask you more about self-compassion, maybe, like how to have that at a deep level. I mean, you know, all my friends think of me as an intellectual, and somewhere maybe I'm not enough compassionate to myself, more compassionate to others than myself. So I just wonder, I mean, what is it exactly, I mean, that self-compassion is about, other than maybe just empathy and stuff? Is it how do you generate a feeling of being comfortable with yourself under a lot of uncertainty, situation?
Well, there isn't always a feeling of comfort. And like you, you know, I am a self-proclaimed intellect. And so our inclination is to say, how do I make this work? There's got to be a pattern. There has to be a way. what is it, how can I find it? And no matter what it is you do, it doesn't work. Briefly, you know, when I left my job to go into this exploratory life of mine, and you can read all about it on my blog, you think that, okay, God is leading me down this path, and then suddenly everything goes horribly awry in absurd ways. My cat came down with an undiagnosable illness that cost me 1 month's worth of living expenses. This wasn't in the script. So I am frequently, like you, confused, baffled. What do I do? Because there's no intellectual construct we can hook onto. And sometimes you all you can do is lash yourself to the mast of faith. And you can scream all you want, but you hang on to that until the mast breaks. And now you're floating in dark, cold water. And the thing you hold on to is that you will be kept afloat. Things are going to fall apart one after the other until you get to the level you need to be, and God only knows what that is. And then it starts to move in a different direction. I will also say to you, if you feel you are drawn to a life that compels you to dance on the edge, you make sure you have your tribe with you. And your tribe are people who don't think you're nuts, are probably walking down a similar path. They get that the confusion is real, and not only real, but understandable. And they're not trying to fix you, and they're not trying to dissuade you. Your tribe are the people who will be there for you to cry on their shoulder. They will be there to give you a bowl of soup. They will be there to make you laugh. They will be there to share their heartbreak with you. You find your tribe, and you cling to them as if your life depended on it, because it does.
Wow.
That is incredible. Thank you so much.
Okay, we'll talk.
Uh-huh.
Thank you, Jan.
Hi. Hi, Jan. This is Anu. I'm calling from New Jersey.
New Jersey! An East Coast person!
Yep, good old Jersey, or dirty Jersey, depending on your take on it. But thank you so much for sharing your life with us. It's been a real honor to hear everything you've said. And so much of what you've shared about living an exploratory and an experimental life has been resonating with me in my own experiences, given the path that I'm on. My question is about the example that you shared about your client who used to end up making you feel cold. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could speak more about what it is about the client that was having that effect on you. I know you said it was because the client sort of was compromised in some way and, mm-hmm. you know, was seeking to draw energy from you. Mm-hmm. And also what you recommend for people who are in that situation, especially with loved ones, you know, where mm-hmm. they want to help them, mm-hmm. but it's very difficult. So if you have any suggestions and tips on that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. All right. So the first thing I would say is please don't rely just on what answer I give you. I'm happy to share with you what I can, but do please get somebody close to you, you know, some resource near you that you can also rely on. Having said that, clinically speaking, this woman was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. I don't know that I ever completely bought into diagnoses. They tend to be very static, and, you know, if somebody changed, would you know it, because you're kind of locked into a label. But, you know, for people who truly struggle to understand that they can stand within their own power and have, you know, they make choices and that we interface with each other, it's almost like that component doesn't exist, and I'm not even sure of why that happens. But this woman was very, very angry in a very subtle,
quiet way. Mm-hmm. It's almost impossible to describe it. Certainly, there was something about her that was very controlling, but I also get the sense there was something about her that was very wounded.
Mm-hmm.
And so for people like that, and it, she doesn't, the people in your life don't have to fall under that diagnostic, there are simply some people who find it extremely difficult to, almost, if I can put it this way, it's almost like they can't breathe on their own. So you have to help them breathe and breathe for them. And and as I described it energetically, they're like energy vampires. Let me have your energy because I don't know how to create or sustain my own.
Mm-hmm.
And those experiences are very real. They're unmistakable when they happen, and yet it defies explanation.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we defend against it? There are ways, but some people are more experienced or more comfortable than others. So let's remember that there are levels in ways of dealing, and if you're not prepared to deal at a higher level, you just deal where you can. And sometimes I believe it really does become necessary to say this far, no further. You just have to set the boundaries. And there will be tears, and there will be recriminations, and there will be guilt trips, and there will be everything. But that's when you lash yourself to the mast. And you say, this far, no further. Because no one has the right to suck you dry.
Great.
You have got
Thank you
to,
so much.
Because nobody can be you but you. And if you give yourself away, if you give all of your life force away, you cease to exist. And you must exist.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense to you?
Yes. Yes, it does. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Thank you so much, Jen.
Jen, what I wanted to tell you is, you know, as we started off with this call with those reflections on how we've dabbled on different parts of your journey. And to me, just not just looking at the breadth of all the different things you've done, but just to look at the excellence with which you've done it, it's very clear to me that it's not just with awaken calls, maybe with the Reiki part of your journey or the counseling part or the musician part, whatever you've touched it to the most, you know, to the bestest possible amount that you could get out of it. It's so inspiring to know someone who can go with such depth into something and gift the world with so much that she could get out of. I don't know if that makes sense. I hope it does. I'm very thankful to you. We are all very thankful to you. And we are so excited to be on this journey with you. And I want to thank you for helping all of us see that little silver string that connects us, for helping us lift that up, and for reinforcing that connection today. Thank you so much. We love you.
Well, you can't see it, but I am smiling so broadly. Maybe you can see the light glowing from Connecticut, but it's been such a deep pleasure, not just to talk with you, Vinya, but to share with everyone on the call. It has been such a blessing to me, and I just send you all of my love and my very, very best wishes on your own journey.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jen, for being a part of our tribe.